Okay, he's, yeah.
No, it's Thomas.
I'm sorry? Thomas?
Thomas, the question yesterday.
Of course. Where's Thomas?
Yeah.
Not the one with
the... Green?
Yeah, one has...
Literally, at night, you mean?
No.
Hope.
Oh, green's in the sense of hope.
Yeah, that thing...
That's what I prefer, the word creative engagement, than the word non-grasping. Because the word non-grasping seems to imply we must not do any grasping whatsoever. When actually I think that we don't come in contact, that we don't aspire, that we don't have hope or dream, but that we have a different encounter with them. So I think, yes, commitment, effort, courage, dedication, perseverance is, I think, very important and are very important qualities. So, in a way, it's a line between insisting and I want it this way, or insisting as in perseverance. Even if it's difficult, I try it, I go for it. So, I mean, it is a fine line, because it's the same when we meditate. When we meditate in a way, we insisting all the time, you could say. We can't. We are living it, we are facing it. So I think, in a way, my only guideline would be, in the continuum, the perseverance, is it a fixing type, which brings tension? Or is it kind of what I would call a steadiness in the focus of where we're going? That's the difference maybe I would make there.
You know? They say that the Eskimos have 19 different words for snow. And I think the Buddhists have almost as many words for desire. And unfortunately in English, I think we often sort of muddle it all up into craving and grasping, and desire is sometimes, all forms of desire are thereby seen as problematic. But that's certainly not how the Buddha presented it, as I see it. There are forms of, for example, the longing for transcendence that I've spoken of, which in some traditions is spoken of quite explicitly as a form of desire. The desire to go beyond one's limits, the desire to wake up, the desire to live a moral life. These are not the sorts of desires that cause us suffering and pain. One way I found useful in differentiating this is, it comes in a Mahayana Abhidharma text, that craving is problematic. Or we can recognize what craving is as opposed to, let's say, a healthy desire, because it projects onto its object something that the object cannot actually deliver. In other words, a craving is based on an exaggeration, a distortion of the object it desires. For example, we crave to have a particular computer, let's say, and that craving has its power because we think if we had that computer, it would deliver something, happiness or status, but in fact it can't. So it's based on a cognitive error, an emotional error. That's the kind of craving we call grasping. It's grasping at something that actually will not fulfill it. But what the Buddha is pointing to are things or ways of being in the world, or states of mind, that are entirely legitimate to seek and to insist on, that hopefully will somehow lead to fulfillment rather than frustration. So if you differentiate between these different kinds of longing and desire, then I think we get round that problem. Similar to what Martin said, really. To have a clearer sense of like Dhammacanda, the Buddha speaks of, which is something like affection or a longing for Dhamma. But that's not the same as tanha, or craving, or thirst, in that negative sense.
And then,
ethics and consciousness. The Buddha, are all conscious. Well, I said that not in an entirely approving way. What I mentioned was that when I was trained as a monk, I was taught, according to that tradition, the Geluk tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, that the Buddha has no concept at all. There's no conceptual mind operating within the Buddha. Personally, I don't believe that. To me, that doesn't make sense. There are any number of people who will tell you what the Buddha's like and what wonderful experiences they've had. I don't want to comment on that. That's not my own experience. But in terms of trying to understand who this man was, what made him what he was, I don't think it has to do with his having somehow abnegated or gone beyond those elements that we would normally consider to be integral to our humanity, the capacity to think clearly, to articulate himself clearly, to be able to respond intelligently and wisely to the dilemmas and the questions of his time. The Buddha did all of those things, and I cannot understand how that could be done in a kind of non-conceptual state. I frankly can't understand. Sorry? Well, I don't quite see it like that. To think of the Buddha as just playing out a kind of a role, sort of playing a game, I feel again is denying him his humanity. And that I can't accept. To me, the Buddha is deeply and fully human. And he has all the characteristics that human beings have.
And also, I think it's very important to see that, of course, in different traditions, even in Buddhism, there have been different trends of talking about going beyond everything, and generally the first thing that seems to go with that going beyond anything is ethics. But the Buddha was very clear about ethics, very clear again and again and again. He comes back to ethics, he comes back to not killing, to harmlessness, and there are many, many different texts where he really again and again talk about it. So I think a little careful there. Of course people can have different interpretations of what they might think, but the Buddha himself, in the text itself, the ethics is a very one of the greatest components.
The way that the Buddha speaks of his way of being is not so much in terms of having risen to higher states of consciousness. This is not a language we find, really. But rather, he talks in terms of his capacity to no longer be bound or tied by certain deep-seated drives and habits, ignorance and greed and hatred. In other words, he's not, I think, so interested in describing some elevated state of consciousness. He's concerned with finding a way that he claims to have found in which he is free from the imperative or the power of certain habits, let's say, that drive us into limited and unfulfilled states of consciousness. I don't find this talk of levels very helpful, frankly.
No, but
Okay, look forward.
You mean the four stages? Okay. It is in the tradition, it is believed that the Buddha attained the fourth level, so that the Buddha dissolved belief in self, dissolved belief in right and ritual, dissolved doubt, dissolved greed and hatred, and let go of conceit, restlessness and ignorance. In the tradition, that's what it is said, that he achieved all the four stages.
All these things have somehow fallen away. Why is it beyond any condition?
Because it's there all the time to be left.
Well, to me that's a state of readiness, a state of a sensitivity and presence of mind that is the consequence of the conditions of his intelligence, his presence. I don't see it as unconditioned. It's simply a very present state of mind, and I think it's something that all of us can likewise aspire to at any moment. That's right, yes, and I think the Buddha's the same. The Buddha, I mean, I think we always have a problem here between the Buddha as a kind of ideal, which is a very valid way of looking at it, and the Buddha as an actual human being. And I think in some ways we're speaking here somewhat idealistically. We're using this word Buddha, not so much to describe a man called Siddhartha Gautama, but actually to talk about a way in which we can be in the world, a way in which we are not subject to endless distractions and confusion and fantasies and desires, but actually we are more and more and more present to exactly what is going on. And Buddha is a way of describing the optimal possibility that a human being can have to be present at all times. And I think there is a spectrum from a very confused, very distracted state to one in which one is increasingly present to whatever has occurred. And the Buddha, as a person, is acknowledged by Buddhists as one who is, in a sense, optimally aware. But that is still the consequence of his training and his practices and his insights and his thing. It's conditional.
But when you just said all the time is...
That's an ideal. And unless we were able to invite Siddhartha Gautama into the room and say, okay, Buddha, now what's it actually like? I think you can never really answer that question. As a Buddhist, I have a faith, as it were, that kind of presence of mind is possible. And in some of the people I've met in my life whom I most admire, some of my teachers, for example, it seems that they, in a way, come quite close to that. And that's something that's very inspiring as a possibility for myself.
It is constant, but it doesn't mean that it cannot stop. It will stop when they die. You see, again, I think it's a problem. Why does it not change every second? Because it can be relatively constant, but it's not eternally constant. It can never stop, and then you have no idea. Are they still either way as they were before? I think, in a way, the problem is there is a relative constancy. Is that the ocean? You know that the ocean is there. And I'm thinking for the next 100, 200 years, the ocean will be there. But I am not totally sure. It could, you know, be sleep, whatever, and the ocean could disappear. Or it can be in its heart. Sometimes it's
quiet. Let's put it this way. I mean, I think this is an ideal to which we can somehow aspire. We can take as a model for how you or I might wish in the best moments of our life to live. That's what makes a difference. I'm actually not terribly interested in whether the Buddha was, you know, 24, 24. in a constant state of mind. In some ways I find that a little bit difficult to imagine. But I wouldn't, I don't think that's really so interesting, frankly. I see it really as a tool, this way of speaking, these images, these ideas, are really a tool, tools of inspiration, that we can use in our own lives to try to maximize and optimize such awareness in our own daily life. That is what matters, I feel. The rest is really speculation and metaphysics. I don't think it really matters.
Also, according to the common Buddhist view?
The common Buddhist view. I'm not sure there is such a thing as the common Buddhist view. One of the things I like about Zen is that it punctures, or it's quite happy to discard some of these common Buddhist views, because they tend to create these kinds of rather impossible and unsolvable and unanswerable questions. And the quote I gave this morning, when an ordinary person is awakened, we call them a Buddha. When a Buddha is deluded, we call them an ordinary person. To me, there's a kind of truth in that that brings the Buddha down to earth. I feel the whole teaching on Mara shows that the Buddha is constantly engaged in a similar kind of struggle and conflict as we are, except perhaps that he's better at dealing with it most of the time. That's my sense. But as soon as we project any kind of perfection onto a human being, we lose something crucial about their humanity. For me, Mara is a way, a symbolic way, a mythic way of talking about the Buddha's own conflicted humanity that the common Buddhist view or popular Buddhist belief wishes to eliminate. I think it's very important not to lose the human dimension of the Buddha, and that means to let go of all notions of perfection. Good. Yes or no to the question?
You were commenting how much you...
All this mythology, yes, this is the word. It fleshes out what otherwise would remain rather flat and two-dimensional. Buddhism is not just a kind of manual for enlightenment, like a manual of how to fix a car. And we have a series of steps. It's often presented like that. It's, you know, stages of insight. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. First stage has 5 sub-sections. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you kind of go through it as though you are trying to sort of build a motor car. I think this is, it loses so much to start getting into that sort of mechanical, technical language. I think the beauty of the mythological aspect, the importance of actually trying to understand the Buddha's life as a human being in his historical context, all of this makes the whole thing three-dimensional. It makes it all human. In other words, it resonates with us at all levels of our body, of our emotions, of our imagination, of the whole human being. If we restrict Buddhist teaching to just a kind of series of techniques, we lose, I think, its heart. So many hands going up. I think you had your hand up first, and then we'll come back to you. Yeah. Did I say that? What I mean. At any level, no. To me, life and death are utterly inseparable. Also, life is meaningless without death. But the whole understanding of what life is one that implicitly, at least, is a recognition that life is always a moving towards death. That life and death are not two things at all. Again, I think, I find that Heidegger says on this is very good. That life is toward a dying. It's constantly a moving to its own end. And life as something separate from death is unintelligible.
But what about the other way around? The death is a consequence
of death. Yes, of course. Well, the thing, you're thinking in terms of life in death. You're thinking in terms of two things. They're not. Life is a flowering out of conditions of birth that inevitably then vanishes and dissolves and comes to an end. And that life may then continue through your descendants, through your own genetic continuity, but no, your life comes and it goes. And I don't see that as being in any sense dualistic at all. But we may be speaking on a different way, I think. Yes.
Just for you say, I think this is an interesting subject, and at the same time I feel everybody has to kind of try to explore it. My main idea is that practically you're supposed to observe the feeling thought. And that's why I talk about can you notice either pleasant feeling thought, unpleasant feeling thought, neutral feeling thought. Personally, I can give you a chance to try. And you might prove the point. I have no idea. But, you know, I feel I should kind of at least mention this. Personally, that's something I can never kind of really apprehend. So, but I'm coming down to what I was doing this afternoon. So I was presenting the tone, which I think are very subtle and very difficult to get. So, I have a friend who said, yes, she can experience them, so that's what. But she thinks she says she can experience them in reality, so what can I say to that? But what I can experience, and that's why I introduce it, and I think it's kind of useful, is to, we have what I would call a feeling sensation. Feelings are something we experience in the body. And this is very useful. You feel something. For most people, but not everybody, because I know somebody who experienced feeling at the back of the neck, so again, everybody can have different experience, but generally most people have a kind of a feeling sensation in the solar plexus. And what I see is that a lot of the time people are caught by their feeling, and they're very afraid of their feeling, and they're very kind of lost in the feeling. And I feel that if we, in meditation, when we sit in meditation, we feel relatively okay in general, then I feel it's easier then to pay attention to that, which is not the heartbeat, and it's not a kind of like a specific bodily sensation. I find it interesting to not name it, to discuss, to see with it. And I feel that when we're in daily life, it can help us to be more aware of the feeling, and then maybe to deal with it in a different way. But I don't think you can experience feeling that as a, essentially a physical sensation. But of course, it's something that's more, if you start to go into the story of it, then yes, I mean, it can be much more than that. But I'm trying to go back to the starting point. That's what I was trying to do this afternoon.
No. I don't see the Eightfold Path as in some ways, yes, you can see that there is a continuity. I will come back to this a bit at the end. But in some ways, the Eightfold Path is like a feedback loop. In other words, it's not a linear process that you start with right view and you end with right concentration, then you can pack up your bags and go home. But rather, each step of that path is, as it were, the condition that then allows the next stage in the path to come forth. So the way we see the world becomes the condition for the way we think about it, the way we make choices, which is the condition for what we say, for what we do, for how we earn our living. That is then the ethical foundation for how we make commitments and effort. And that then allows us the basis for mindfulness and concentration. But the mindfulness and the concentration are the conditions that enables us to look to fully know suffering, to let go of craving. But the whole thing is continuously spiraling round and round. Yes. You can enter it in your it could be the practice of livelihood. That could be where you are at that moment in your life. And that is just, you can begin at any point there. It's holographic in that sense.
Yes.
Yes. There still seems to be an obsessive thing around here. The Buddha does not use, except perhaps in one instance, in the Katayanagota Sutra, the word duality or non-duality. I feel that the practice of the middle way is arguably the starting point here. This is a middle way between the extremes of indulgence and self-mortification. In the Katayanagota Sutra, he takes this at a more sort of philosophical level and speaks of the middle way as a middle way between being and nothingness, or being and non-being. So in that sense, yes, you can think of this middle path as one that is a constant alertness to the possibility of veering off into one kind of part of the whole rather than embracing the whole picture itself. And to that extent, I feel that the very core of the practice is one that is constantly sensitive to the danger of splitting. So in that way, we might call it non-dualistic. But that's rarely a word the Buddha would have used. That's more or less how I would take it. Starting with the two extremes of mortification and indulgence, and then going down to things like being and non-being, and avoiding those extremes. Embracing them both, in other words, not recognizing you can't have one without the other. You can't have Buddha without Mara. I mean, that's not in the text, that's me. But I feel that follows quite consistently from such a perspective. Yeah. Nirvana is really just a way of talking about the letting go and the falling away of a particular relation to the world. Yeah, of course. What is all experiences? The Buddha doesn't really speak in terms of time and space. I mean, there are texts, I suppose, that suggest this kind of completely going beyond time and space. But frankly, that means nothing to me. I can only take that really as a kind of inspirational statement, as something that is a language that points us beyond our limitations. But if we take it literally, I find we end up speaking unintelligibly, or at the very best, poetically. Yes. The basic one to the best. Okay. How much time we got? Okay, we'll do it very briefly. Zen Buddhism is a form of Buddhism that emerged in China in the 7th, 8th century and has subsequently been developed in Korea and Japan. And it's a practice of Buddhism that is in many ways very influenced by Taoism. And so it's got a peculiarly Chinese flavour. But the practice in Zen, if you say... Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about this more. But basically, Zen is another way of doing Vipassana. If you take the word Sitantaza, which is often translated as just sitting, doing nothing, it actually means Samatha, Vipassana, together. Sitantaza. Sitting together, Samatha, Vipassana. Our teacher likewise understood the practice of the koan, asking a question, what is this, as a unification of Samatha and Vipassana. Vipassana has been co-opted by one reformed Burmese school as somehow, somehow identifying a difference from all other forms of Buddhism. But Vipassana is a term that runs through every school. There are many different ways of doing Vipassana. So we'll come back a bit to this more.
You have Buddhism, and you have the Buddha. Then you have the Buddha teaching in India. Then he goes to Sri Lanka. Then he goes to China and various places. Then what is interesting is that when he goes to to Sri Lanka, they call themselves the old school, the school of the elder, Theravada. And then you have the other who calls them the small school, because they are the Mahayana, the bigger school. But you know, this is kind of, you know, like any tradition. Apparently in the Jewish tradition it's the same. You have many different strands. And then people have different ideas about some texts, different ideas about practice. But in a way they start from the same place and then they go and do that. This is the same with Buddhism. You have many, many different schools of Buddhism. You know, you have the Tibetan, the Zen, the Vipassana, within the Vipassana is part of the Theravada. And then you have many, many more. And each state a little slight, a little, oh, more looking at this, more looking at that, putting emphasis here or there. But one thing generally they all agree upon is the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Three Characteristics. After that, then, they can say different things.
I've run out of time.
Okay.
Quickly. Possibility of choosing. Yeah, that is the weakness. I mean, Heidegger falls very short when it comes to ethics. He says nothing about ethics, effectively. And that is clearly a severe weakness in his work. And it is translated as a weakness into his life. And I think, though, the philosopher who somehow complements Heidegger ethically is his student Immanuel Levinas. And Levinas regarded Heidegger again as one of the five greatest philosophers of all time. But he detested Heidegger as a person. And Levinas's philosophy of the other and of the faith, I feel, in a way, brings Heidegger's work within to a very profound ethical frame. That is my point. What is that? What I feel is what the Buddha is saying. I think the Buddha is saying the path is actually something we are called upon to create, to bring into being, is the word he uses. And it's also one of the passages in the Pali Canon that I'm very fond of, is where he says, after his monks have received their sort of initial training, he says, go forth into the world for the welfare of the many, for the good of the many, and let no two of you follow the same path. Now this suggests to me very much that each person is called upon to engage with the world in a way that is individuated, in a way that is responding both to the specificity of the situation you meet and in terms of the specificity of your capacities at that given moment. And in that interaction, you live, you, as it were, respond, you act, you speak, and in doing that, you are in the act of opening up what Heidegger calls a delisting, the lighting, the glaze, the spark. Life is able to flourish. And that is really what is meant, I feel, by the path. And it can close down.
We'll
come back to that.
And then tomorrow we'll start.
And we'll start with this.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, something much more interesting than the dining room. Thank you.